I'm very happy to be joined today by Henrik Andersen, the CEO of Vestas, the global leader in sustainable energy solutions. Vestas is a Danish company, over 125 years old, has been making, manufacturing and selling turbines for over 40 years, about 35 of these years really specialized in wind turbines. Largest manufacturer in the world by capacity, operating in 30 countries with close to 30,000 employees and with revenues of around 15 billion euro a year. Before he became the CEO of Vestas, Henrik was the CEO of Hempel, a global supplier of coatings and paints. Henrik, thank you very much for joining us today. Let me start by asking you a comparison today of the cost of wind energy versus hydrocarbon or coal. Historically, of course, wind energy was more expensive. Today, I think the comparison is much more favorable. Give us an idea where we are.
I think the real change has happened within the last decade. When we exited the financial crisis in 9 and 10, reality was we needed government subsidies in somewhere around 99% of the world markets from governments. Today, coming into the 20s, it's the complete opposite. We need subsidies in less than 1% of the world markets to be competitive. When we then sort of look at what's the cost of energy in comparison, which is often mentioned as the levelized cost of energy, onshore wind sits somewhere around 40 to 45 euro per megawatt hour. If we compare that to the coal, which is typically half of that for established coal, and if you compare it to fossil, it's typically a third of what goes on in the fossil world. And of course, then when you look at the new nuclear established larger plants around the world, it's off the scale. So it's typically works around a tenth of that, which is the starting price for new nuclear electricity.
So onshore wind is actually a lot cheaper than any of these other solutions.
It is.
Okay.
It is.
Now, of course, one of the challenges is onshore wind is dependent on the wind blowing, I guess. But when it's blowing, the point is it is now cheaper.
Again, please forgive me for a naive question. How predictable is wind? And you know, just like the sun doesn't always shine, when we have turbines, do they produce like 100% of the time, 80% of the time?
Is there like an average turbine works, 60% of the time on average or 80% of the time?
You will work typically towards the 40-50% capacity usage, depending a bit on where you are in the world and what site suitability you have.
And how about offshore?
Yeah, you can say the offshore, you can always question, will offshore ever reach the complete same level in the levelized cost of energy? Because imagine you are sailing something out, you are digging typically into the seabed, you are drawing cables back to shore. So therefore, when we look at the comparison today, you have offshore sitting somewhere at a price tag which is somewhere around 50% more expensive than the onshore. But of course, where you can find close near shore, not deep water near shore, then of course offshore becomes relevant and also more cheap compared to that. But still offshore is more expensive than onshore.
So more expensive than onshore, but given the numbers you gave us a second ago, can still be less expensive than some of the fossil fuels.
Absolutely. There's no competition in that anymore.
How does the carbon footprint compare?
Interestingly, we have put up approximately 160 gigawatt over the last 4 decades. That means our turbines replaces 220 million tons of CO2 every year. That's equal to what 130 million passenger cars on the road emits in CO2. And if you want to have it translated into a proper tangible turbine, we use CO2 through the steel and through the manufacturing to produce the blades and the nacelle. But that means in the life cycle of a turbine, after approximately months 4 to 5, the turbine goes CO2 neutral, and then in reality becomes CO2 negative for its remaining life up till plus 30 years.
Wow. Okay.
So a very quick return on investment from a carbon perspective.
Yes. Yes.
Now, the value chain. You make wind turbines. What do you buy from whom? And to whom do you sell what? Because there are some names that we know of. We all know of Ørsted, for example. I think Ørsted is a client for you. So tell us how the value chain works.
You know, as you see the value chain, you have thousands of components that goes into it. So when you see a turbine and you pass a turbine, you will often see three blades, you will see a nacelle, you will see a hub, and you will see a tower. But of course, inside all of that, there is quite a lot of electronics. There are electronics components, of course, that also makes it possible to connect to the grid, and therefore the electricity comes back to the grid in a format we can use from the turbine. So for us, we source a lot from a global build supply chain across multiple countries. We have put turbines up in more than 85 countries, and we source from similar back to in-country factories in just less than 20 countries.
So you design them, and then you manufacture them, and you install them.
Exactly.
And then you service them also.
And then when, as I said, for a customer like Ørsted or a customer like most of the global utilities or infrastructure funds, then of course the real interesting part of the journey starts when we have commissioned it, because that's the first time in the whole built process where they start having a revenue. And that's the interesting, that's the day one in our service maintenance partnership with the customer, which then makes the turbine last as much as 35 years.
Let's dive into the company as such. So, revenue-wise, Vestas has been doing very well. You've enjoyed very good growth. And as you mentioned, you're number one in the world. Fair?
Yeah.
Now, the challenge is that the gross margins, and even worse, the EBITDA margins, have been low for years. And in fact, in 2022, were so low that you ended up losing significant amounts of money. Now, I read a quote from you in the Financial Times where you said, look, it's a little bit of madness to see that the solutions we provide for customers have never been so valuable, but we're losing money. And in fact, for a while, some of your customers were making a lot of money. So basically, what's happening? You're making a great product, your clients love it, they make money with it often, but somehow we're not able to capture enough of it at the Vestas level.
Yeah. No, I think we need, and therefore I always go back, and I think there's something we probably have spent most time in also, first of all, mitigating, but also getting into and understanding what is it and where is it that there is a disconnect in a supply chain like ours, because the resilience we had in a global supply chain is very fairly robust. But of course, when you suddenly start seeing that the COVID gave an enormous backlog on inbound, especially on containers, which means we start lack of components, but we have an obligation to also deliver our turbines, because as you said, we all see it's critical infrastructure, because it did make electricity in all markets, also under COVID, where we needed the electricity. So having to deliver on that in years where components are suddenly becoming in shortage, and we are restricted on getting our components in time, that gave a very unpredicted inflation into our long order backlog.
Okay.
And of course, if we see how a structure work in a project for wind turbines, typically it goes over 5 years. You work on a permitting. When you get to a permitting stage, then you also get a permitting, you get a financial closure, and you get a price on the turbines.
Okay.
And then really starts another 2 years where we ramp up to the deliver of the turbines before the electricity
takes starts. About 2 years to make the thing.
Yeah, and if you go into see, as we announce every quarter, we announce our backlog of turbines. So I always got used to that. Having a big backlog is a fantastic positive, which it is for most companies. But of course, for us, the backlog suddenly was that we couldn't hedge all of the variables in the backlog due to the supply chain shortages and scarcity. And there we were hit much harder than probably most industries, which is coming back to my comment of, it is a pretty tough one to sit with, that we are losing EBIT weighted EBIT on the individual turbine, while the output from the turbine and electricity price, in Europe at least, was in many cases 15, 20 times more valuable than it has been in the last 10 years. Can we ever overcome that? Not completely. But one of the things we've also seen is that in the binding period where we say to the customer, you have a binding offer from Vestas, that has been shortened from probably in previous COVID days, 6 to 9 months, now down to something which is a month to 45 days, where you have to clear your variables as a customer. So we have of course stepped back and saying, we can't live with that situation. We can't live with that our turbine as the asset is the one that bears the negative consequences of the market volatility.
So what you're saying is, look, we sign contracts after 2 years of permitting and discussions, and these contracts essentially are signed 2 years before we deliver the turbine.
Yes.
And if I understand, you're saying these contracts typically don't forecast any form of significant inflation of any kind. And over the last 2-3 years, because of COVID and because of other factors, we've sustained significantly greater inflation, including because we were scrambling around to get the components. That would mean that the low EBITDA is temporary. It's related to the situation and the backlog. Does that mean that 2023 is going to be good and 2024 great?
I'm always nervous about good and great. But as I said, in financial terms, we are aiming for coming out of something that was close to 8% negative EBIT last year. We are aiming at something that is around the zero this year. We'll fight really hard to get to a small black number. And then next year is also on our way to a 2025 with a 10% EBIT. So that actually sets a little bit how volatile it has been. Can you take some fixed points in that? You have seen our pricing in general increasing somewhere in excess of 30% on the average selling price over the last 10 to 12 quarters, which is a good indication, average, of where the market has actually been, which also is a positive for us because it also means that it is temporary, but also reflecting back and saying, you sort of said, well, it was inflationary measure. Yeah, come on, stop a second. A container price to get across the world went from somewhere around $4,000 to in some cases $30,000. And then for us, even worse, you might not get it on time. So one thing was that you potentially could pay the enormous price uplift, but the other thing was you were not even sure you could still get it.
Understood. Now, 2-3 follow-up questions on this, if I may. How much differentiation is there between you and your competitors? Can we say that the Vestas turbines are better than theirs?
There is a difference. And there is a difference in, first of all, how we test. There is a difference in how we also provide life cycle guarantees on the turbine. So therefore, there is a difference. And we can see that. And therefore, both from a technology point of view and a quality point of view, we absolutely put an effort into that.
Reason I'm asking, Henrik, is because there are some products that are hard to differentiate, right? Where, and so basically it becomes more of a low-cost sort of strategy, where if we can show that our product is better, obviously we get some pricing power. That's what I was after.
Yeah, no, and I think here you can also see part of it when we start talking about that 10, 12 quarters ago. If we didn't have any pricing power, I don't think we would have been necessarily in a position where we could have increased prices to the point of what we have done. And I also know that here for us, it's very much a testament that it's not just a turbine. It's also making the solution come online.
Okay.
Because you as a customer, you really want to say to the government or the country you're building in, at that date, you can count on that there's more energy flowing.
Okay.
So that is where the turbine is the piece of hardware, but has all the soft and also technology that has to be connected and provides you. Otherwise, it's just a turbine standing there for fun.
And the reliability, I guess, of you as a project manager.
Yeah, that's again a question of do you have any lost production time? And that also means that the capacity and the availability of not only the turbine, but the wind park is there.
Now, another factor that I read about as a contributor to cost potentially, I guess also as a contributor to a reduction in the cost of production, but of electricity, but then as an increase in the cost of production of the turbines, is this sort of technological race toward bigger and bigger turbines. How costly is this for you to have this race to bigger and bigger turbines?
I think it's always a balance, because if you are in an industry where technology development actually adds to the efficiency of the solution, you will always have a very important driver of your technology in there.
Okay.
On the other hand, it also has to balance off if you don't have the technology long enough that you get the manufacturing scalability in and therefore the cost out structure. I think that balance the industry probably has to some extent struggled a little bit by finding. And I think this is back to the point of, is the industry mature or versus immature? And I will say in the onshore, fairly mature. In the offshore, maturing, but still not mature. And that's where there has been an unbalance of people have come out, said there is a new turbine. This is what they call an arms race. And there we are just saying, come on, guys, now we got turbines and we got technology out there. They are strong enough from one turbine to provide electricity to 20,000 households in one turbine. At least that will last probably throughout this decade. And that will also give us an opportunity to both localize and scale the technology. So it's finding that balance. As you will appreciate, as a leading voice in the industry, I think we need to talk to that, because if we don't talk to it, then it just continues being a bit silly money thrown into the technology.
So you expect that there will be a slowdown in this arms race over the next few years?
Yeah, also because we can see, for instance, in the US right now, where the IRA has come as a government initiative over 10 years, a lot of that links into that it also provides electricity into hydrogen and therefore into the electrolyzers. And there you have to catch the whole range of wind rather than just high or medium wind. So it designs also the turbine for what you want to have out as an output.
Now, we've seen significant capacity growth and revenue growth, as we've discussed, but in fact, you've been arguing that we could have had even more growth, but part of the problem is that governments are apparently struggling to accelerate the awarding of permits. One statistic that I read leading up to this discussion is that the capacity stuck at various stages of the approval process is about four times the volume under development. So if we're developing 100 right now, there's another 400 that's kind of stuck somewhere along the approval process. Why is it taking so long?
Now, I think let's two things. First of all, we got a political system that basically have delegated a lot of the permitting process to our local communities. And when you delegate authority on that level, of course, you also delegate and